Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Growing up in the 1980s and 90s, Sarah McCammon's Midwestern family was steeped in the evangelical church. She was taught to obey God, not to question her faith, and that her eternal salvation was secured in heaven. For the most part, McCammon followed the rules. The young girl who would later become a journalist was a true believer and tried to help save the people around her who didn't follow Jesus. But after covering the Trump campaign for NPR in 2016, McCammon saw the power of evangelical Christian beliefs on the political right. She's since joined a growing movement of ex-evangelicals, people rethinking an entire worldview and identity and walking away from the conservative religious community. She's written about the journey in her debut novel, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. I sat down with Sarah to talk about her book and what it feels like now to have so many people know her personal journey. Here's Sarah.
I spent a lot of time thinking about what I wanted to say, and I want to be clear, you know, I had had my own kind of break from the evangelical church quite a number of years before I covered the Trump campaign, but while I was covering it, this community that I had come from was such a pivotal part of the conversation about where the Republican Party was going, where the country was going, and I spent some time talking with evangelicals who were uncomfortable with the alignment of their movement with Trump. Now, I, you know, wouldn't have called myself an evangelical anymore at that point, but I knew that world really well. And people who knew that about me began to ask sort of, well, what do you see? How do you make sense of the evangelical support for Trump? And I, you know, decided I wanted to answer that by writing a book. And one of the things I did come across in the course of that reporting was ex-evangelicals, people who, like me, for various reasons, had made some kind of a break with their childhood faith. Many of them felt like the movement was overly politicized and was veering into extremism. And the Trump moment didn't necessarily cause this rupture, but it sort of spotlighted it and I think catalyzed conversations around it. And you're right. So I couldn't, you know, I couldn't totally, I tried in my reporting to separate myself as much as possible.
Yeah.
But I knew that I knew a lot about this world and gave it a lot of thought, decided I had things I wanted to say. And
yeah.
And I think now I feel pretty good about what I said. I mean, I spent a lot of time thinking about how to design this book, how to interweave my experiences with these conversations with lots of other people who've walked similar paths.
Yeah. No, you should feel good. I mean, this is very thoughtfully written, and it's clear once you pick up the text. Here's the thing. You know, we are taught that religion is just one of those topics that we shouldn't typically broach with people, right? Unless you've got some level of comfort there already. Were there parts of this story that were difficult for you to share publicly?
You know, it's funny, there's that old cliche, right? Don't talk about religion and politics.
Yes.
But how can we not right now? I mean,
it's so true.
Religious ideas are infused into our politics in ways we sometimes discuss openly and sometimes don't, but they're right there under the surface. And I grew up in a household where we did talk about those things all the time. So I'm quite used to talking about them. You know, in many ways, I think I became a journalist because I wanted to get away from that a little bit, at least from talking about them in a way that felt like I was coming into the conversation with predetermined answers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, journalism is about asking questions more than having answers. But of course, there were things that were hard to write about. I mean, I wrote about my family. In order to write about my childhood, I had to talk about my family, and I tried to be very thoughtful about what I said. But I talked about some of the difficult dynamics in our family. A central character in the book is my grandfather, who was one of the very few people I knew growing up who was not an evangelical Christian, not a Christian at all.
Right.
You know, I talk about growing up in this world that was, as many evangelical kids do to one extent or another, that was totally surrounded by evangelical Christian media, my Christian school with its own Christian textbooks,
right,
some of which taught things that were frankly inaccurate or missing important context in retrospect, and Christian TV, radio. It was a whole, you know, what I and others have described as a parallel universe,
yeah,
in a way. And my grandpa was the one person I knew well who wasn't part of that.
Yeah.
And it was that created a lot of tension and pain in my childhood and even to this day. And that was difficult to write about, but it was so important to this story. Anytime people ask me, you know, how did you go from where you were to where you are now? My grandpa is always part of that conversation. And so it had to be part of this book, too.
And we'll talk more about your grandpa because there's so much there to discover. But I want to go back to your childhood and sort of have you define the evangelical church for me. At that time, what did it mean to you, to Sarah the child? What was your understanding back then of the core beliefs or the mission or what you were responsible for?
So there were theological beliefs, and then there were also political ideas that were becoming more and more infused with those theological beliefs. In terms of theology, you know, we believed that the Bible was literally true. It was inerrant. And that led us to believe things like the earth was 6 to 10,000 years old. We had a, you know, creationist view of the origins of the world. I was taught that in my Christian school. We also, you know, we focused, of course, as most Christians do, on Jesus, on salvation through Jesus. But there was a real sense that we had to share that. And, you know, the word evangelical comes from the same root as the word evangelize. Mm-hmm. And so we were told to, you know, pray for the salvation of my grandfather, witness, share the gospel with people that believe differently. I had a youth group activity once, or I think it was a retreat, where we went out on the streets in Kansas City and handed out, you know, Christian tracts and asked people, if you die tonight, do you know what would happen to you? Which was kind of the opening line we were taught. And, you know, we regarded anybody who didn't agree with us, and not just certainly people of other faiths or no faith, but even other types of Christians. We were skeptical of Catholics. We were skeptical of mainline Protestants. As, you know, not saved, likely not saved at least. So it was kind of a narrow little box in retrospect that I sort of grew up, that my world was sort of constrained by.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the political beliefs, the way that I was raised, were really just infused with that. I mean, I write about James Dobson, who was a high-profile evangelical leader. He started out primarily as a sort of therapist, marriage and family counselor, doing parenting advice on the radio and in books, and became hugely popular in the evangelical world, hugely influential, and from that spun out into political activism for the Republican Party, and still to this day, even though he's in his upper 80s, is involved in Republican politics. And so in my world, there was really no separation between Christian and Republican. I mean, I remember going to an evangelical college here in the Chicago area, and there was one family that was Democrats that I knew of. I'm sure there was more than one, but there are very few. And I just remember being like, wow, how does that work? Like, how can you be a Christian and a Democrat, you know? Because those things were just synonymous for us.
Your parents truly lived the scripture, train up a child the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. And I remember you writing about when you were 10, Sarah, and you got your very own lavender leather Bible.
That's right.
King James Version. You were so proud. You wrote inside, believer's baptism, 8 years old, saved, 2.5.
Yeah.
What did that mean?
So in many Christian traditions, in fact, it's an older Christian tradition, infants are baptized to be welcome into the faith. And in some forms of Protestantism, particularly evangelical Protestantism, that ritual has been replaced by adult baptism. And there's a whole history there, which I'll leave to church historians and religious scholars. But most evangelical churches today don't practice infant baptism. They practice adult baptism. And that means that you have to have sort of accepted Christ, accepted this on your own before you can be baptized. So, you know, instead of baptism and confirmation and the kind of rituals that you'd see in many, many other churches, we believed you had to sort of pray a prayer of accepting Jesus. That's how you became a Christian. That was sort of it was almost a replacement for a ritual, but it was kind of a ritual. Mm-hmm. But we believed it was more than a ritual. It really meant something spiritually. And then when you got older, you could make a choice to be baptized, which I did when I was 8 years old. And I, you know, it was, you know, a big mega church, one of the early mega churches. So there was a big tub in the back that they would uncover, you know. And
I did my version in 2015 at a mega church in Rochester, New York.
Yeah.
And it was the same deal. It was overwhelming, but, you know, that was sort of the way to go as a Christian.
Right.
Yeah.
That was what we believed in. Yeah.
For sure. Well, I want to go back to your grandpa now, right? Because you thought, as a child, you grew up thinking, grandpa's going to hell. You opened the book, sort of introducing us to him and his story. Now, he had come out as gay, you know, wasn't a believer like you and your siblings and your mom and dad. What was it like to watch your family shun him back then? And then now, looking back, how do you feel about that behavior?
What I remember more than anything was just like a horrible awkwardness and tension. And I didn't fully understand it when I was younger. I just knew that we were, you know, we saw Grandpa. We would see him at Christmas. Sometimes he would come over, you know, every now and then if I was sick or something and bring me a gift. And you know, I knew that he was somebody that was really respected. You know, he was a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon. He was retired when I was pretty young, but active in the arts community in Kansas City. And, you know, he wasn't the kind of person that you would be cautious about, but we didn't have a closeness with him. And I think I probably assumed that it was just because we didn't share the same beliefs. And we were really concerned about that. We worried about his soul, but we didn't, you know, unlike a lot of grandparents, I didn't spend the night over there. I didn't, you know, I wasn't a closeness. Mm-hmm. We weren't estranged either, I want to be clear, but we weren't close. And when I was, and I describe in the book, when I was about 12 or so, how I discovered that sort of this secret about his sexuality had been hidden from me. And, you know, my parents told me that they were worried that if we were around, after they told me he was gay, that if we were around gay people, it would normalize it for us. That was the word that they used. And that was what my church taught. That was what my Christian school taught, that homosexuality was a sin. And I think I just accepted that. But I also felt this kind of unease in the family. There was just always this unease about being around him and knowing how my parents felt. And it was just a real source of cognitive dissonance for me, too, because I had to sort of confront the fact that there were people who lived and believed totally differently than we did.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I got older, I did get to know him. I spent more time with him. And I'm grateful that I had many, many years to do that. He lived a very long life. And, you know, in retrospect, I mean, this is something I'm very sad about. I'm sad that I didn't have more time, more of a normal childhood family relationship, I guess. I think it would have been really healthy for our family to have been closer. But I think it just wasn't possible because of the ideological divide.
When we talk broadly about evangelicals, I want to be clear of the demographic, Sarah. So can you break that down for us? I mean, we're not just referring to white Christians when we talk about evangelicals. Like, who makes up this group?
The term evangelical is one that, you know, scholars and pollsters argue about and struggle to define. And I mean, generally, it refers to conservative Protestant theology, you know, an emphasis on salvation through Jesus, an emphasis on the authority of the Bible and on sharing one's faith, as I described, and often some kind of charge to activism, whether it's political activism or working to help the poor or otherwise. I mean, that's historically what it's meant. But when we talk about evangelicals today, it's really important to talk about race, because while many people across the American church may share the same theological beliefs on paper, regardless of skin color, regardless of race, race is really determinative of how people vote in this country. And Black Christians and white Christians who believe similar things vote very differently. And certainly there are some parallels, right, from church to church. And the evangelical movement is so big and complex, and it's made up of sort of subsects and intersecting and cross-pollinating, you know, streams of Christian thought. And so it is hard to categorize. But the reason I have the word white in the subtitle is because the politics of the white church are so different than the politics of the Black church by and large. And then you can talk about, you know, other groups as well, Latino evangelicals. Is a growing group, and that's another conversation altogether. But, you know, there's a chapter in the book called Leave Loud that focuses on a group of Black Christians who had spent a lot of time in mostly white evangelical spaces, white seminaries, white churches, and really around the time of the rise of Donald Trump, and then a couple of years later with the police killing of George Floyd, came to feel that their churches, as much as they might pay lip service to wanting to be diverse and wanting to include people of color, they weren't prioritizing the concerns of their brothers and sisters of color. And so Dr. Jamar Tisby and others kind of led this mostly online movement called Leave Loud, which was to say, if churches aren't prioritizing the issues of concern for us, we're going to leave and we're going to let them know why.
What have been the biggest drivers, Sarah, for ex-evangelicals to leave the church? And I wonder if there was a particular moment for you where you said, I don't know about this.
Well, the book is sort of organized around different themes, and it's certainly not exhaustive. There are many reasons, as many reasons as there are people. And, you know, some people sort of have found these ex-evangelical social media spaces like Facebook groups and TikTok hashtags and
Everyone's path is different.
Yeah, everyone's path is different. But there is sort of, you know, what I call an online movement, really, of people who are finding each other and talking about this experience that a lot of people call deconstruction. And it involves coming to terms with what they've been taught and what their church teaches and then trying to make sense of it of sort of what they experience and see in the world. So one of the big drivers, I mean, certainly this, as I've mentioned, the last several years, the political divisiveness of the last several years, I think have prompted a lot of soul searching for some people. They've also just prompted other people who had a discomfort with where the movement was going to talk about it. So I think, it, you know, extremist politics might be one reason. Certainly the evangelical view of LGBTQ people is a big theme. You know, there's a lot of polling that suggests that younger evangelicals are much more accepting of same-sex marriage than their the older generations. And I think
there's a divide within.
There's a generational divide. Yeah. Those are some of the big ones. But there are as many reasons as there are people. And for many people, it's a lot of things that kind of come to a head.
Mm-hmm. So sex and sexuality, I mean, they're particularly complicated topics for post-evangelicals who are immersed in purity culture. And they're taught from a young age to deny their natural bodily urges and, you know, no sex before marriage. You write about this also as it pertains to the ultimate destruction of your first marriage. But I was struck by the email that you wrote to your parents to announce your divorce. And you say that their reaction was kind of the worst that could have happened.
Yeah. You know, I didn't include their email in the book because, frankly, I had to talk about them, to talk about my childhood and to talk about my own sort of interaction with evangelicalism. But I didn't want to make it any worse than it needed to be. So suffice it to say, I had really hoped that they would understand and support me when I was going through that. And I think they just, much like they weren't able to understand my grandfather's sexuality, they weren't able to understand the decisions I'd made and the struggle I had gone through.
Yeah.
And that's really painful. And it's a theme I hear a lot from people who've made a break with their religious community, a sense of rejection or judgment. You know, there's this rhetoric that we love you, we accept you, but it doesn't always feel that way. You know, the purity culture
comes with conditions.
Yeah, it feels that way to a lot of people. And, you know, purity culture sort of reached its peak in the 90s. There were these books like I Kissed Dating Goodbye by Joshua Harris, which was a huge bestseller, which many, many millennial evangelicals read. It was often formative in their view of sexuality and marriage. And, you know, fast forward decades later and, you know, come to find out for a lot of people, this sort of rigid view of sexuality that was very narrow and very strict, it led people to rush into marriages or to avoid relationships out of fear of, you know, quote unquote, sinning. And so, you know, I talked to a spectrum of people, and there's been other good work on this by others. There's been entire books written about it. But I wanted to at least touch on it because it is a big theme. And I think sexuality isn't easy, I don't think. I mean, relationships aren't easy. It's hard to figure out how to get it right.
That's right.
But what purity culture offered was this formula that kind of promised that if you follow this, it'll all work out.
Right.
And in the real world.
Until it doesn't.
It doesn't always.
Right.
Yeah.
Until it doesn't work out. Let's go back to Trump for just a moment, right? As I said at the beginning, you know, you covered Donald Trump's presidential campaign back in 2016. We all sort of know this story. We know Trump appealed to many evangelical Christians while also driving some away from their faith, I would say is fair to say. But even now, as he's facing, you know, criminal charges for his involvement in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, we still see that some evangelicals strongly support Donald Trump. What do you make of this? Why? Why is he the guy? When he's not of the religious community, but he's just been made to be this tool to get the message across.
You know, this was like the big question that hung over the 2016 campaign and that kind of launched me on the reporting that led to this book. You know, I talk about in the book remembering the way that my evangelical community regarded former President Bill Clinton's moral failings, you know, the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. And, you know, many of the same evangelical leaders or people associated with them who spoke out loudly then about the importance of character, fast forward 20 years later or so, were aligned with Trump. And it, one of the things that prompted me to write this book was I was doing a story in 2016 about evangelical women who were really just sort of mystified by the release of the Access Hollywood video and the response of the evangelical movement to that and to Trump. And for some women, that was kind of a breaking point. That was when I actually first came across the term ex-evangelical, a woman who said, you know, I don't even want to use this label anymore. Mm-hmm. But you're right. For many others, they were happy to overlook that. And I think if you look at the messaging that Trump used, the idea of making America great again, in many ways, it echoes some of the ideas that evangelicals had been hearing from their leaders, from their pastors, this idea that, you know, America was once a Christian nation that was in decline, that had fallen away from God, whether it was, because of the sexual revolution or the rise of secularism or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that message resonated for some. And, you know, Trump, he courted evangelical leaders. He promised to do the things they wanted to do, like overturn Roe v. Wade, and he got that done. And so I think in many ways, it's not that big of a surprise. He might not have been, you know, the line I've heard before is, we need a president, not a pastor. Or God uses flawed people. You know, we've heard all of this from evangelical leaders.
Yeah.
And I think that pretty much sums it up. It's this idea that Trump needed a base, and the evangelical movement, especially seeing sort of the decline of white Christian cultural power, mm-hmm. needed a champion. And they found, you know, sort of a partnership in that.
Later in the book, you write, quote, "For those of us wandering out of evangelicalism, we can find ourselves in a foreign and often frightening spiritual and emotional wilderness." What's been the scariest part of leaving your faith?
You know, for me, there were just so many things over the years that didn't add up. The way that we thought about my grandfather, the way that we thought about my friends of other faiths, the way that, you know, many of the people around me refused to accept scientific fact. All of that made me feel like I had been misled. And I was also taught, though, to be authentic, to seek the truth, to try to do what's right. And so when you feel like trying to do what's right and seek the truth conflicts with some of the other things you've been taught, it's a very sort of confusing and overwhelming place to be.
Yeah.
And so there were just these moments where I felt like I can't endorse this project. I don't think this is who I am.
Where does the strength come from to stand against that?
Well, I mean, it's, I think, I don't know if it's strength so much as it's just being unable to pretend, you know. I didn't want to pretend to be something I wasn't or to believe something I wasn't, and especially to try to promote ideas that I didn't feel were good ones. Mm-hmm. Then the question is, where do you go? What do you do with, I mean, I'm still a person that has an interest in spirituality and certainly wants to try to understand what's right and good, which I think is a lot of what religion tries to be about, at least. You know, how are we supposed to live? What are we supposed to believe in? What should we do while we're here? And I still care about those things. And so when the answers you're given sort of in a nice little box don't seem to work, then what do you do? And I think my whole life has been kind of a process of trying to figure that out, mm-hmm. but also being more okay with not having everything figured out.
Though you are a self-described ex-evangelical, you're still part of a religious community, right? You still believe in Jesus. You still pray. Where are you finding hope these days in the state of the church and just the state of this country?
Well, I would say I never described myself as an evangelical when I was, and ex-evangelical is not a term I, you know, necessarily would use. I mean, I think it does describe me, but it's not as if I've like taken on this mantle and this is who I am. You know, it's just when I heard that word, I thought, wow, this really describes something that I understand, which is having been part of a community and leaving it. And, you know, what I really want people to understand about evangelicalism is that in many ways it is a subculture. It's a robust culture. Like there are cartoons and books and movies and songs and just a language around being evangelical that's sort of distinct. And when you leave any community, there's a loss and a grief and a need to kind of figure out where you go next. These days I go to church sometimes, especially on important holidays. Mm-hmm. That's important to me. I'm also in an interfaith marriage. My husband is Jewish, so we go to synagogue quite a bit. Mm-hmm.
But you haven't converted, right?
No, I've not converted, yeah. And that's meaningful for me. It's something that we can share. I feel like I can pray in a synagogue or a church or anywhere.
You said in the book that being with him may be a gift from God.
It feels that way, yeah. I mean, I feel like I've learned from seeing how someone raised in a different tradition experiences faith. You know, it's just a different sort of set of assumptions and expectations and none of this fear of damnation, which is refreshing. But, you know, I didn't write this book to tell anybody. I mean, this is my journey, but like I didn't write the book to tell anybody what theirs should be. I just felt like something was happening that I wanted to say something about, particularly because this community has been so influential in shaping our politics.
So leave us with this. Who's this book for? And if nothing else, what do you want the folks who read it to walk away with?
I mean, it's truly for everyone. I think I'm hearing from a lot of people who grew up evangelical who are saying, wow, this is my story. I feel so seen. And that's exactly what I hoped would happen. I'm also hearing from people who come from other faiths or don't really understand the evangelical world and are like, wow, this really explains so much about the culture. I've always struggled to figure out what the evangelical culture is all about and how what the thinking is like, and this explains a lot. So it's really for everyone. And I hope that people who are still in evangelical churches will read it, because I don't think it's anti-faith at all. It's really about my journey and the journeys of quite a number of other people I've talked to. And I hope it will provide sort of some empathy all around and just some insight into what that's like. At one of my signings this week, a couple came up to me and said that they were sort of deconstructing or rethinking some things, and their adult children were as well. And it was harder for their adult children. They were kind of picking my brain about, you know, what they should do. And I don't like to give advice, but I was really just happy to hear that question being asked, you know, especially if there is sort of a generational gap or divide. I hope it will foster true conversation, you know, not debate, not argument, but let me hear you. Let me understand why faith is so hard for you, or why this kind of faith is so hard for you. And I think some of the responses I've appreciated the most are from people in my life who are still religious, maybe even evangelical, but are just curious and open and compassionate.
And you're certainly a great storyteller, so it makes for a wonderful book. That's Sarah McCammon, journalist and author of The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. The book is out now, and you can find it wherever books are sold. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Ethan Schwab and me, and it was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. Make sure to check back on the podcast this afternoon and subscribe to our newsletter so that you don't miss a thing. You can sign up for that at wbez.org/resetnews. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.